Traveller's Tales.
Welcome to Traveller's Tales here on Premier Radio. I'm Patrick Forbes and my traveller today is Eddie Arthur, Executive Director, Wycliffe Bible Translators. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What's your earliest recollection of bumping into God?
Earliest recollection, I must have been three or four, because it was before we moved house when I was five. We went along to church. I remember that. And from about seven or eight, I think, I was sent out to Sunday school. My mum and dad, they were religious, but didn't have an active professing faith. They weren't regular churchgoers themselves. So there was always a Christian-ish atmosphere around the house, but nothing definitive. That started to change when I was about 9 or 10. I grew up in the northeast, as you might tell by my accent. And when I was about 9 or 10, my mum started going to evening services at an evangelical church. And my elder brother also started going, and he became a Christian and was baptised. And I remember my dad was really pleased about this, but didn't say much more. I learned later on that my parents had been very, very active Christians in their earlier years, but they had a number of sort of unfortunate experiences, miscarriage and things like that, and ended up moving house away from the close-knit mining village that they'd lived into the big town of Sunderland, and they'd lost their contacts with church. And really, so that was just before I was born. For most of my early life, there was this remnants of their active faith. I remember my dad getting a Bible for his birthday. So that was there, but it wasn't actively practiced. My dad died when I was 12. That was just a couple of years after my brother started going to church and becoming a Christian, and my mum had sort of started to rediscover her faith. And that really sort of put a seal on things for the family. And my mum was very supported by folks in church and really, you know, engaged again very deeply with God. And it was a couple of years after that that I began to realise that I had all these religious thoughts. I had, you know, I could have passed a Bible test or whatever, and lots of Sunday school. And it was all there, but it wasn't alive. It was a summer when I was 16. For a couple of weeks, I just had this sort of nagging feeling at the back of my life that I was religious, but I wasn't right with God. And I went on a church holiday camp a weekend up in Northumberland, not showering and not washing for a weekend, you know the sort of thing.
Dirty socks.
That's the one. you were there. And it was during that time that my brother just asked me what was going on in my life, and very gently and very sensitively, totally unlike an elder brother, to be honest, he very gently led me to the Lord. There was never a time in my life when I wasn't aware of the reality of the Christian faith.
But you had to make it your own.
Yes, had to make it my own, and it was a long journey for a teenager. It was almost all of my life.
What did you hope to do with your life before this happened in Northumberland?
Well, I was only 16, and
sure,
I didn't really anticipate anything. I just, you know,
just get on with it.
Yeah, I wanted to be in a rock and roll band, basically. I just couldn't play an instrument.
Well, lots of people in rock and roll bands couldn't either, I don't think.
Oh, please, please. No. it was, as I became a Christian, also, you know, started doing A-levels and O-levels and A-levels and things, that my life started to coalesce. And there were two strands that were at work. To finish the story, I became a Christian on a rainy night in Northumberland sometime in August. And the next day, the Sunday, you know, the camp finished, and we all went into... It was sort of tradition in the church that all of the people who'd been at the camp, all the young people and hangers-on, would sort of troop into church together and sit at the front on the night after the camp. And we did, and I fell fast asleep in the sermon. It was the first time I'd gone to church in my life where it meant something. I mean, I'd been going to church every weekend for years, and it didn't mean a great deal. Now it meant something, and I fell asleep. But the speaker that night was a missionary from Belgium, and he was doing an after church, and I paid special attention. Basically, I was feeling guilty. I can't...
Having slept through one.
Yeah, having slept through his sermon, I basically was far too guilty not to listen to his talk. And at that point, within a very short time of becoming a Christian, I felt the Lord say to me, I want you to be a missionary and serve me in a French-speaking country.
Gosh.
And that was very clear there. At the same time, and that was always in the back of my mind, at the same time, I did my A-levels, I went to university, and basically had the desire to become a professional biologist, to be a biological researcher. I wanted to lose myself in academia. I went on to study for a PhD in biology. I know more about one enzyme in the broad bean than anybody on the planet.
Wow.
Which is not really useful.
Oh, I don't know. You never know.
But always in the back of my mind was this sense that the Lord wanted me to be a missionary in a French-speaking country. While I was at university, I met my wife, who was doing a degree in French. So I married her. As I was doing my 3 years as a postgrad in Southampton, Sue and I started just testing the waters with missionary organisations. You know, nothing worked. You know, went to all the missionary organisations working in Europe, those working with students, church planting. I'm a preacher, so we were looking at, you know, pastoring. And just there were no open doors.
What did that make you feel like?
Confused. Very confused.
Frustrated, I'd have thought. Yeah,
very clear sense that the Lord was calling us into something and not a clue what it was. But there were a couple in our church who were with Wycliffe, and they came and did a presentation to the youth group. I have to say, it wasn't the most exciting presentation. And trying to be encouraging, I asked questions and I got into the swing of it to try and help it go along. And Sue, who's a linguist and wanted to be a professional translator, she was fascinated by Wycliffe Bible translators. And so this couple latched onto us and saw us as people who were would be keen to work, you know, good Wycliffe types. I just wasn't interested because we had a call to work in a French-speaking country, France, Belgium, Switzerland. But eventually, Sue, because she was interested, and me, just basically to keep this couple quiet, agreed to go along to a weekend at the Wycliffe Centre. We went along, and it was like being hit by a truck. It was just so obvious that this was what God had for us.
As gentle as that, eh?
It wasn't gentle. It was just, you know, what have you been wasting your time for, Arthur? This is what I've got for you.
Right.
Because my wife is a translator already. Translation work's ideal for her. Myself, as a research scientist, the work involved in developing an alphabet and trying to understand a language for the first time.
Writing a dictionary,
all of that, it used the skills that I had professionally as a scientist. And I discovered that there are countries in across West Africa where French is the national language.
Ivory Coast,
which is where we ended up, Togo, you know, we just saw all these countries. When I look back, the Lord was very, very gracious. I think it was important to my continued walking with him that I had a call to mission work, because that was always something that when I drifted away, you know, as you did as a teenager, brought me back. You know, the Lord has a plan for your life. But if he'd said to me, on the first day I was converted, I want you to go to Africa.
You'd have run in the opposite direction, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'd have got on a ship for Tarshish, like Jonah.
Ended up inside a whale.
Yeah, the whales had been queuing up for me. So, you know, the Lord was very, very gracious. He gave us the guidance we needed at the time and then expanded it.
And the equipment that you needed for the eventual job.
Yes. You know, why was I doing a postgrad work as a biologist? It was developing skills.
Broad beans.
Yep. I grow them, but, you know, I never...
And you know about the enzyme.
But I've never actually looked at an enzyme since. But the skills I had in terms of research, in terms of, you know, drilling down and how do you answer this question?
Precision.
What are the issues, the precision? That came in very, very handy in working in language work in Ivory Coast.
So having been hit by a Wycliffe truck, then what?
My three-year contract was coming to a close, so we went to Bible college for a year.
Where did you go?
Went to Moorlands. Many years later, I'm now just considering joining the board of Moorlands, so that's goes full circle.
Did you enjoy going to Moorlands?
I'd just done 7 years flat in universities, and Moorlands wasn't the same environment, and I didn't adapt very well. I think I'd have got a lot more out of it if I'd had a break from the academic world, because it didn't have the rigour of being a postgrad at a good university department. It was a different sort of training. Sue really enjoyed it. I was just frustrated because it wasn't what I was used to. But that was my fault, not Moorland's. We then came to the Wycliffe Centre, where we spent a year studying linguistics and translation, and then went and lived in the south of France for 7 months so I could get my French up to...
Oh, shame.
It was the coldest winter on record. You know, I thought, great, we're going down to the south of France for the winter. And it was minus 20 one day.
God has a way of saying, don't get too comfortable here.
That was right. And the coldest day of the year, the central heating in our flat packed up. Our eldest was 5 weeks old when we moved to France. That was challenging.
So you yearned for a really hot French-speaking country.
That's right. And then in early 1988, we headed out to Africa. And we were based in Ivory Coast for 12 years in a place called Guabafla. The nearest town was Vavwa, which, if people know much about mission work, a missionary school was there for a while. But we were in a little village among a people called the Kuya people. The nearest tarmac road was 20 miles away. There was no electricity, no running water. By then we had a two-year-old and a brand-new baby. And it was interesting.
It must be very tough.
Well, they thought it was normal. You know, they loved it. You know, as soon as Sam could walk, he could just go out of the front door and just go off all day. You know, nobody in the village would hurt him. Everybody looks after him. He would wander from household to household, scrounging food. Rural life, no traffic. It was absolutely idyllic for the kids.
And what was the work like for you and for Sue?
At the time of recording this, it's just around the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And everybody's asking, where were you when you heard the news? It passed us by. Because 20 years ago, we were just settling down into this village. And we were so tired. I remember the news happening, but didn't remember much about it. It was mainly just the sheer grind of, you know, being a family with young kids, living in a new place. No electricity, no running water made it hard. And then trying to learn a language which wasn't written down. And a language which is tonal, so that changing the musical note of a word changed its meaning. So just very simply, eh is me, eh is you. Eh. Me, you. Eh. Trying to learn that and then reduce it to writing and then to work with a team and develop literacy materials to translate the scriptures into Kuya. It was hard going. I mean, it was very, very tiring. It was exhausting.
You had no electricity, so did you try and record electronically the sounds that you heard?
Yes, we had a couple of very good tape recorders, and not mini discs as you use today, but we had good cassette recorders. But we had solar panels on the roof that would allow us to use laptops and inkjet printers, so we could type things up, and we had good software for working with non-Roman alphabets and things like that. I do remember when we first printed off the Gospel of Matthew that we wanted to print off, you know, lots of copies so people could test it and check that the translation was right. And that was going to exhaust our batteries. So we actually drove our truck, we had a Land Cruiser, right up to the office and ran cables from the batteries into our solar panel system. And we had the truck revving for 8 hours just outside the office. It was one of the hottest days of the year, and you got this great big Land Cruiser more or less in the office door. It was so hot, but that kept us going for the day.
A motor-driven translation.
Motor-driven translation. It was good stuff.
Very good. Yeah. And how did it go down with the people locally?
People were very excited, you know, to see their own language written. You know, people would tell us as we were learning the language, our language is not like French. It doesn't have grammar, you know, because they'd gone to school and had to learn French grammar. Our language doesn't have grammar. And we would show them that it did. And we'd show them how the grammar of their language was more complex than French. And that gave them a sense of value. Oh, you know, we're just nothing. Our language isn't a real language, not like French. But your language is.
Yeah.
And as they start to realise that their language is important, that's just so encouraging. You know, we matter. Our language matters. But perhaps the most encouraging thing was when we tested the Beatitudes with one of the church leaders. And he read through the Beatitudes and said, nobody's told me this before. Now, he'd been reading them in French and in other African languages for years, but he'd never got the sense of them till he got them in his own language. And just the excitement of seeing somebody grasp what it means to understand God's word in their own language was phenomenal.
How did it make you feel?
Excited, elated, very, very privileged. And also there was that bit of me which was thinking, well, that's Matthew done, but it's only 10% of the way, or whatever. You know, the New Testament is so long. There is nothing more exciting on the planet for me than opening up the scriptures, be it in a pulpit, a Bible study, or as a translator, and seeing people get hold of it.
For the very first time.
Yeah, that's what I'm wired to do. That's what I enjoy. So that was fantastic.
It must feel a bit like St. Paul arriving in Colossae or Ephesus for the first time and making sense for people.
I think so. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it really is. There's the grasping the sense of the Bible. There's the sense that God really loves us. You know, God isn't a foreigner. Just the meta message of the translation is important. We lived in this village for 6 years, and then I was called into a leadership role in the capital, in Abidjan.
I've been there.
You've been to Abidjan?
I have.
We were in Abidjan for 6 years, and my wife, Sue, who is really the translator in the family, carried on the translation and the Kuya New Testament was complete in 2002. And I took on a leadership role there.
How difficult was that after being, if you like, at the coal face?
Well, in some ways it was nice and easy because Abidjan is a well-developed city, you know, running water, electricity, air conditioning. So, you know, in some ways, you know, just, you know, being human, it was easy. But we'd invested a lot of our lives in that village and the house we'd built and the friends we'd made. And it was heart-wrenching to leave. And we only left for a year, but there was always a suspicion we'd never go back, and we never did. You know, we were pulled out for a year to do a job temporarily, and temporary has the tendency to become permanent.
So what happened then?
We were based in Abidjan for 6 years. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I mean, for myself, the ability to be able to have an impact in translation on more than one language and encourage people was fascinating. I had responsibility for two countries, Ivory Coast and Mali, and so travelling between the two was also interesting. Very different, you know. We'd been living in rainforest, and then to go and visit and get to know work in the Sahara was very, very different and very encouraging. But I think there are two things that mark my time in Abidjan, and they occurred very close together towards the end of our time. The first was around Christmas of 1999, coming into 2000. We were just about to leave the country and go on holiday. And actually, we'd left Abidjan, we're driving north up the country, and behind us in Abidjan, a military coup took place. And so we were driving up the country, and we didn't know it, but basically there was a military coup following us. And we didn't find out till we got over the border into southern Mali, where we were staying with friends.
Much better that way.
Far better that way, but one of my colleagues had to take over and lead the group through the trauma, and we couldn't get home for quite a while. We were isolated on the wrong side of the border. And then, just over a month later, and things quietened down, it's remarkable how, you know, you think the world's coming to an end, but you know, a week later the supermarkets are all open again and things are more or less back to normal, but feeling very jittery. A month later, my boss, who's based in Nairobi, was coming through for a trip to West Africa. And he and his wife set aside a day, it was a Sunday, to spend with Sue and I. And we spent that day on the beach, basically talking through work, but it was a Sunday. We decided rather than being in the office, we'd sit in a beach hotel. And we had a wonderful time, and it was one of those days which would sit in the memory always. And they then had to fly home to Kenya. And so we dropped them off at the airport, which was on the way home from the beach, and thought nothing of it. 2 o'clock in the morning, this was late evening, 2 o'clock in the morning, a phone call came through from colleagues in the US saying, "Are Bob and Ruth," that's my boss and his wife, "with you?" And I said, "No, we've just put them on a plane to Nairobi." And said, "Oh, we hoped you hadn't, because we've just got news that the Kenyan Airways plane has crashed off the coast of Abidjan." It turned out that Bob and Ruth had both died on the flight, and a few other people that we knew. And I had to identify the bodies for the Canadian embassy and things like that. And so, you know, that marks the whole of the experience in Abidjan that time. That was just about 5 months before we left. And so in many ways, when I think back to Abidjan, it's hard to think beyond the military coup and then 3 weeks later, my boss and his wife dying in a plane crash. You know, I look back and it sounds bizarre, but I'm very grateful that I was able to perform a service for them. Be of some use and identify them and get them back to their families in time for a funeral in Canada. It was a harrowing time.
It's not the kind of thing you go looking for.
It's not, and it's not what you sign up for.
No.
You know, when I joined Wycliffe, I was going to be a Bible translator. I never thought that I'd be in a mortuary, have to deal with the aftermath of a coup. I mean, Wycliffe were very good. They sent a counsellor out to make sure that I was still this sort of sane. And, you know, I never thought that was not the sort of thing I was expecting would be part of my life. But it was, and, you know, very aware of God's presence through it and aware that he grieved far more than I did for Bob and Ruth. Thinking of Jesus at Lazarus' tomb, weeping, that this is not something that God did callously.
See how he loved him.
Yeah. It was, you know, a very strange time in many ways, but it confirmed in so many ways the living reality of God and to some extent helped me to understand the people I'd been working with. You know, it is so hard for somebody who is as privileged as a Westerner. Most British people don't realise how rich and how privileged we are. But, you know, people in many parts of Africa would have 4 or 5 children because only 2 or 3 will survive. And a number of my African colleagues said to me, well, we feel you're more one of us now because, you know,
we've seen
you suffer bereavement. I mean, I'd suffered bereavement. You know, my dad had died when I'd been younger. But as an adult, I hadn't. And it really helped to draw me closer to a number of my African colleagues.
What happened then?
In middle of 2000, we came back to the UK. We'd got to the point where the options for our kids' education were getting limited. They were in a French government school in Ivory Coast, and they could have carried on in that. But if we'd gone on another year, we'd have been into sort of GCSEs, A-levels, we couldn't have changed. And at that point, we just felt with all that we'd gone through, it was time for us to come back. And if we came back for a while, then we'd be making decisions about the children's education. So we came back, settled back into Southampton, and I took on a role within Wycliffe, coordinating training across Europe, the training of translators.
And your wife?
Sue carried on with the Kuyu New Testament for a couple of years and made a couple of trips out to Ivory Coast and drew that to conclusion. And it was great when some of our Kuyu team members came over to the UK to do the typesetting. And that was fun, showing them Salisbury Cathedral. When you lived in a Kuyu village, Salisbury Cathedral was quite something. After the Kuyu New Testament was complete, she was invited to go out to Madagascar to work as a translation consultant, helping work there. And that was very special because David and Sam, our two sons, each of them had their best friend in class were two Malagasy boys, two brothers. And Sue had got to know their mother. And so the boys were really close to these two lads, and Sue was very close to their mum. And as we left to come back to England, they left to go back to Madagascar. And then Sue's asked to go to Madagascar so she could reconnect with her friends. And I think it was 2005. We had a brilliant Christmas where this Madagascan lady and her two sons actually joined us in England and had Christmas because one of them was studying English in Southampton. And it's kept that contact alive, which has been great.
So when did you come here?
2008. I applied for the job of executive director of Wycliffe and came up to... I was appointed in March 2008. And I tried to commute from Southampton, which is where our family home was, but life was too short. I was spending time... I was staying with friends up here and then going home at weekends, but it was far from ideal. So we made the decision just as the property market collapsed to move up here, sold our house without any trouble, and then found it very hard to buy one in Buckinghamshire, but we eventually did. So we're settled in High Wycombe now.
What are you hoping for Wycliffe for the next few years?
I hope that Wycliffe can be a vehicle for God's blessing to the British Church. You know, our role is to recruit people, to recruit funds, to recruit prayer for Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Pacific, where Bible translation work is going on. But God is doing so much that is exciting in those parts of the world as people get to grips with what God's word is saying for the first time, as they're excited about it, and they have something which so often we don't. And I hope that Wycliffe can continue to be a vehicle of resources moving to the Southern Church, but can also be a way of bringing God's blessing back to the church in Britain.
A recapturing of the sense of excitement, the sense of gifts and value. And
that's right. And my way of explaining is Wycliffe is like a bridge between the British church and the church in the wider world, but the traffic's all been one way. You know, I'm very grateful for the people and the money and everything and the prayers that have flowed from Britain to the rest of the world, but it's time for something of the excitement of what God's doing to flow back so the British church can be blessed by it.
At this point, I generally ask to whom you'd like a nice Bible Society Bible sent. I have a sneaky feeling that that isn't the question you want to be asked.
What I have here are a handful of blank notebooks. They're empty. And what I'd like you to do is to pass these on to the leadership at Premier Radio, to put on their desks to remind themselves that there are 200 million people around the world for whom the Bible is literally a blank book because they don't have a word of scripture in their own language. So we got lots of Bibles in Britain. It's easy to find them, but there are millions of people who don't have a single word. So here, I have some blank exercise books for you, and it says The Blank Book on the front. If you could pass them on to the good folks at Premier Radio to remind them of the needs of the people around the world.
I'll certainly do that. But
keep one for yourself, too.
I'm still mischievous enough to ask you about giving a Bible work, because it's a long tradition with this program. This is going on 10 years now.
Oh, I mean, 10 years.
Terribly difficult to get out of the habit. I'm a sort of addict.
Who would I give a Bible to?
I'll certainly take your empty notebooks back to Premier, because that would be fun. But I'm going to persist. Who would you like a Bible given to?
Very strangely, I'd like you to give a Bible Society Bible to my friend James Catford, who is the director of the Bible Society, just to say thank you to him for the way we work together and appreciation that making the Bible available isn't just Wycliffe's work, but it's a privilege that we share with others. And passing a Bible on to James. Now, I'm sure head of the Bible Society, he's got millions of them.
Yeah, but this one's going to be special, isn't it?
A sign of friendship and cooperation.
Okay, that's what we'll do. Eddie Arthur, thank you very much indeed for being my traveller today. Listen again, same time next week, for Traveller's Tales. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Traveller's Tales.